Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we ponder why there's another deep dive for investors. Take a look at the fight against ISIS.
The objective in this first year is to degrade its capabilities, to remove its leaders, to degrade its ability to mass and maneuver force around the battlefield, and that's what we're doing right now.
Examine a U.S. email controversy. Talk about the importance of a name change in Alaska. And we'll hear about singer Ruby Amanfu going solo. It's ahead on The Voice of America. Once again, stock markets have plunged around the world, and China is being blamed for it. Reporter Ken Bredemeyer from our economics desk joins us in the studio to explain it all. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, good to be here again, Susan.
Thank you. Well, Ken, what has set off this latest fall?
Once again, just like in the downturns in the last week or so, Chinese growth is being questioned around the world. It's a slowing economy there. It's still rising, but not as fast as it has been. And a lot of traders and investors around the world are concerned. And as a result, stocks are falling.
And I bet this is going to be a big issue when the group of 20 major economies get together.
Certainly when the world's financial leaders talk, global growth is a major concern. And China is the second largest economy in the world. And so when its economy is slowing, that means that there's less opportunity for other countries to sell Chinese products to China. And its exports slow as well.
Well, people are pointing the finger at China, but it's not like China hasn't done anything to stop this economic crisis.
The Chinese government has certainly cut interest rates five times in the last few months in an effort to try to spur more investment. And they've cut the size of the reserves that Chinese financial institutions have to keep in the back to support the problems. But it hasn't worked out so far. The stocks continue to tumble there and then across the world.
It's interesting how interconnected the whole planet is economically.
Absolutely. There's no question, but when a big economy like China's tumbles a bit, then it's certainly felt in Europe, in the U.S., and certainly in emerging economies as well.
Well, thank you so much again for stopping by.
Good to be here as always.
Let's check in with our social media guy, Michael Lippin, and here he's here at the anchor desk with me, on what people are saying on Twitter about this latest market crash. Michael, what's getting attention?
Hi, Susan. Well, the most widely used hashtag to talk about the financial markets today is hashtag stocks. That hashtag has been used a lot in the past month, 232,000 times, in fact, according to Topsy, which is a Twitter analytics website. In the past 24 hours, we've seen hashtag stocks being used about 6,000 times. And many of those tweets make references to how concerns about Chinese economic growth prospects are weighing down on stock markets here in the U.S. and elsewhere. On Wall Street, the main three stock indexes, the Dow Jones, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ, were all down more than 2% at around 1 p.m. local time. In terms of what people are tweeting about today's losses with hashtag stocks, I found a tweet from Ross Gerber. He is a U.S. investment advisor who appears as a commentator on various U.S. news outlets, including CNBC, Fox Business, Bloomberg, and Forbes. His handle is at Gerber Kawasaki. That's the name of his firm. And this is what Ross Gerber said. Here we go, retesting the low. Hold on here. This is part of a process. We must wash out the last weak players. And by players, he's referring to shares of companies that he sees as weak performers. Then there's a tweet that I saw on the account of Mohammed A. El Arian. He is a chief economic advisor at Allianz. And his handle is at Elarianm, that's spelled E-L-E-R-I-A-N-M. And El Arian said, while all Dow stocks are lower today, the market open was an orderly one, especially when compared to last week's dysfunctions. So he's kind of looking on the bright side there. And just before I go, I wanted to let all of our listeners know they can Follow the show on Twitter at VOA_IE. And you can also send a message to me. I'm at Michael_Lippin, and that's spelled L-I-P-I-N. Susan?
Okay, thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
This story might prompt you to get out your broom or vacuum cleaner and do a little house cleaning. But scientists have found that the dust and grime that's been collecting in your home can tell a lot about you. Researchers from the University of Colorado Boulder and North Carolina State University found that the dust, bacteria, and fungi in your home can not only reveal what geographic area you live in, but also the ratio of genders living in your home and if you have a pet. The researchers recruited occupants from about 1,200 homes throughout the continental United States who collected indoor and outdoor test samples at their homes. After reviewing the samples, the researchers found that each of the homes they studied had, on average, more than 5,000 different species of bacteria and about 2,000 species of fungi. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Images from the UN agency UNOSAT released Monday show the main building and a row of columns of the 2,000-year-old Temple of Bel in Palmyra, captured by the Islamic State in May, have been destroyed by an explosion. UNOSAT's conclusion came after comparing Monday's image with one taken August 27th. My colleague Victor Beatty is following the story and joins me now here in the studio. Victor, what have you found?
Hello, Susan. Well, the IS group destroyed the smaller Baal Shaman Temple in Palmyra just last week. Palmyra, known as the City of Palms, located about 200 kilometers northeast of Damascus, was a caravan city during the Roman Empire. It's also a UNESCO World Heritage Site and was an important tourist destination before the Syrian conflict erupted in 2011. Appearing on U.S. television Sunday, Ambassador Brett McGurk, the deputy special presidential envoy to the Coalition Against ISIL, insisted the fight against the IS group remains on track.
It was about a year ago at this point, we didn't even have an Iraqi government in place. We didn't have a coalition in place. And when President Obama spoke to the American people on September 10th, he said this is going to be a multi-year campaign. And that was based on our assessment of ISIL for what it is. It's better in every respect than Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which we fought, best military in the world, and took years to defeat and to degrade that enemy. We said this is going to be a multi-year campaign. We're about a year into it. The objective in this first year is to degrade its capabilities, to remove its leaders, to degrade its ability to mass and maneuver force around the battlefield. And that's what we're doing right now.
But Ambassador McGurk acknowledges the IS group is something the world has never seen before, with some 25,000 foreign fighters joining its ranks from some 100 countries. I spoke with terror expert Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University about an IS video released this week that shows a new currency being minted and circulated in territory controlled by the Sunni jihadist group.
They've done everything they can to be a long-term quasi-state, and in their propaganda, in their magazine, the Beak, we see the idea being floated that eventually neighboring states will have to deal with them, like it or not. So they've got long-term plans. They're not going to take over the entire Middle East, much less build a global caliphate, but they are going to hang on to northern Iraq and Syria for the indefinite future. They might be pushed back into being a smaller state, but they're going to be a state there in effect for a very long time, it would appear. They want all the accoutrements of having a state, including their own currency, because this is a utopian project, and therefore presenting a radical alternative to the world as part of their pitch, part of their appeal.
Greg, one of the top Obama administration officials indicated that the war against IS is going to continue to take many years, and that after the first year, after President Obama announced his strategy against IS, that they have in fact degraded the IS leadership. What is your assessment?
They're certainly taking out some key leaders. We know that. But the problem is IS has planned for this from the outset. They have a very sophisticated leadership structure, most of which is hidden from view. Even now, our intelligence is very limited on this, but we know that they have the capacity for resilience, for replacing key individuals with other key individuals. Even if Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the putative caliph, were to be killed, and the reports earlier this year that he'd been badly wounded, even if he were to be killed, he'd be replaced by somebody else who would play the same role. He's been a very brilliant leader for them, but they've planned for every eventuality, including losing their top leadership. So, frankly, there's not going to be any easy wins for us.
And Barton says the U.S.-led coalition now appears to have a coherent anti-IS strategy in place. But he says it will need a more aggressive response from Turkey, troops on the ground from regional stakeholders, and a much better effort in a counter-narrative to break the cycle of radicalization and foreign recruitment.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, the controversy around a large batch of emails, the significance of a name change to Alaskans, and a new CD for singer Ruby Amanfu. The U.S. State Department has released another 7,000 emails that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton sent and received on a private mail server, not a government one. Ms. Clinton, who is now running for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, has authorized the State Department to release some 55,000 emails from that private server. International Edition's Jeffrey Young has looked into the situation for us. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, Susan. Ms. Clinton, who continues to say that she did nothing wrong, is being countered by others who say that not having all of her emails on a government server where they are accountable and able to be preserved for later examination is not only a violation of protocol, but it may allow her to conceal certain sensitive communications. One person raising questions is Mark Rome, a professor at Georgetown University's McCord School of Public Policy.
One of the first things that I would teach someone who's going to work for the government is that you use government servers and government email addresses for governmental work, and a private server and private email addresses for your personal work. This is a basic distinction that any intern working for the government should know, and certainly should be knowledge that we would expect the Secretary of State to both know and abide by.
The State Department said that out of the emails that were released, only 150 of them were subsequently reclassified. A lot of people in the opposition have been looking for the smoking gun against Hillary Clinton, trying to see if she concealed communications. What can you reflect on this?
You know, no matter how many emails were sent and you try to count up and is it classified, is it not classified, how many were classified after the fact and so forth, that's kind of beyond the point, because then we're getting into the specific details rather than the more general principle of if you're working for the government, use government servers. If you're working on behalf of your own interests, use private ones. We can try to count the specific number of emails that had classified information, but that strikes me as less important than the general principle was that Secretary Clinton was using a private server for governmental work. So the exact number is not important. The principle was that she was using a personal server, that is important. And the public should know about that, and the public should care about it.
Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi has been brought up so many times. There are people out there looking to see if she could have used her private email account so that she could bypass official accountability, not only for Benghazi, but for other incidents. Do you think there's any traction to that sort of accusation?
Well, it does make you wonder. You know, if she's using a personal server, does that mean that she has something to hide? You know, it may be impossible to answer that question. Perhaps she was not. Perhaps she was. But that's why you don't use a personal server. Doing so inevitably will raise those questions.
That was Mark Rome, a professor at the McCord School of Public Policy at Georgetown University in Washington.
Hillary Clinton certainly has raised a controversy with her private email server, hasn't she, Jeff?
Ms. Clinton is quoted as saying, "Looking back, it would have been better if I had simply used a second mail account and carried a second phone. But at the time, it didn't seem like an issue." But, Susan, when you are a presidential candidate or running for the nomination, everything can be made an issue, as you can see here.
Especially politics being involved, the littlest, tiniest thing can be blown out of proportion.
This has become a big story.
President Barack Obama has announced that he's renaming Mount McKinley in Alaska to Mount Denali. That's a name generations of Alaskan natives, some people call them First Americans, have been using, and it means the Great One. And in reaction to this, we are joined on the line by Jackie Pata. She's with the National Congress of American Indians in Washington. And welcome to my show, Jackie.
Thank you.
Hey, what is your reaction to this news about the name change?
Well, actually, I'm from Alaska, so I'm really excited. I think this is a great step forward. In Alaska, we've been calling it Denali forever. So.
And what does it mean to the Alaskan people?
Well, I think it really shows that, you know, in Alaska, we really care about Alaskans. And this is the desire of Alaskans. It's the traditional name in Alaskans. You know, President McKinley never came to Alaska, and I recognize wanting to honor him with the highest, you know, the mountain with the highest peak in the North America. But I think this just really allows this mountain to be represented as what it is, which is an Alaska name, an Alaskan mountain.
Well, John Boehner, Speaker of the House, he's a Republican, as you know, and he said in a press release, and I'll quote it, McKinley served our country with distinction during the Civil War as a member of the Army. He made a difference for his constituents and his state as a member of the House of Representatives and as governor of the great state of Ohio, and he led this nation to prosperity and victory in the Spanish-American War as the 25th President of the United States, and he says he's deeply disappointed. What is your reaction to Mr. Boehner's comments?
Well, my reaction is, you know, Alaskans are really a different kind of breed of people, and we really care about things that are from Alaska, you know, that are Alaskan. And I think it's, you know, time to represent how Alaskans feel about something within their own state. I mean, this is the historic and traditional name. Restoring it to its historic and traditional name and honoring Alaska Natives as well as Alaskans, I think it's the right thing to do.
Some people say it's President Obama reaching out to the people of Alaska and the American Indians, who haven't seen a lot of presidents visiting.
I think this has been a debate that's been going on for 30-plus years. The fact that it's happening when President Obama happens to be here just says the significance of just putting to bed some of these old issues and resolving them in favor of Alaskans.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jackie. I appreciate your insight on this subject, which is so dear to you.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
An Italian farmer's dream of a self-sustainable farm has come one step closer to reality. Luca Remmert's 450-hectare farm near Turin is a testing ground for a methane-powered tractor that could go into production in about 5 years. By then, Remmert says he's hopeful to convert his farm to the production of biomethane so all of his tractors can be running on the fuel.
Significa che in questa azienda potrà essere ad un certo punto un'azienda idrocarburi.
It means that this farm could become run at some point with zero hydrocarbons and we'll be able to say it's completely self-sustainable.
Many experts say it could take several decades to implement such changes across Italy. Remmert realizes that it might make little financial sense for others to convert to biomethane, given market fuel prices, but he remains focused on his goal of a fully self-sustainable farm. I'm Philip Alexio for VOA's Green Beat.
Singer Ruby Amanfu is known for her collaborations with other artists, including Patti LaBelle, Kelly Clarkson, and White Stripes singer guitarist Jack White. But now she's going it alone. International Edition's David Byrd looks at the singer, who covers Bob Dylan, Kanye West, and others, on her new solo CD, Standing Still.
Ruby Amanfu's father moved their family from Ghana to Nashville, Tennessee, when she was only three. She showed talent as early as third grade when she won a pack of gumballs for singing in a school talent show. Nashville is where music critics began to notice her talent a decade or so later. It's also where she met fellow musician Sam Brooker. The two became Sam and Ruby and went on to complete a selection of songs that became their first EP. The Associated Press called their 2009 album, The Here and the Now, the best album of the year.
I'm walking away from my past pride. The here and the now's what we'll make bright if we get to see the morning.
Now Ruby Amanfu has a new CD, Standing Still, which covers several top names, including Bob Dylan and Kanye West. She chose their more obscure tunes so that people could hear her instead of the original recordings.
And I wanted this to feel like a discovery for the listener. Even if they do know the artist, they may not know the song, and I want them to also feel a discovery listening to me for the first time, because these songs are really personal to me, and I want to share my personal story in those songs.
The album was recorded in 5 days in a rural Tennessee log cabin. Ruby says that the beauty of making the album that way with producer Mark Howard, a six-piece band, and guest producers, including the Black Keys' Patrick Carney, is that it felt very organic.
You can wake up in the morning and record, and then you can have lunch and record, and then have dinner and record, and maybe have a glass of wine and do something else if you're in the mood. So, you know, instead of having a normal session where you come in and you're on the clock and, you know, you get one or two down, it was a really great way to do it, and that's why we got so much materials, because everyone was just in the same space and really relaxed.
Ruby Amanfu is known for her high-profile collaborations with other artists. She hopes that her fans can hear all she has learned from others in her solo CD.
I'm excited for the support that I already have from the fans who have been with me in those other forms, and I hope that they are proud of what I have to give now, because I feel that learning so much from all of those partnerships has only made me stronger as an individual artist.
Ruby Amanfu's new album, Standing Still, is out this month. I'm David Byrd.
Down, down, how I long to be a shadow on the wall. I would make no sound.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Goes down the shadow on the wall. It cannot be seen at all.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is making progress in our mission to degrade and defeat ISIL, not only by supporting local forces on the battlefield, but also by eliminating some of its key leaders. In May, Abu Sayyaf, a key ISIL financier who reportedly managed the group's illegal oil sales, was killed in Syria in a U.S. raid. His wife, Sayyaf, was captured. On August 18th, ISIL's second-in-command, Fatih Ahmad al-Hayali, also known as Haji Muez, died in a U.S. military airstrike near Mosul. National Security Council spokesman Ned Price said that al-Hayali's death will adversely impact ISIL's operations, given that his influence spanned ISIL's finances, media operations, and logistics. On August 24th, ISIL operative Junaid Hussein, who was involved in actively recruiting and inciting ISIL sympathizers in the West to carry out lone wolf attacks, was killed in a U.S. military airstrike in Raqqa, Syria. State Department spokesperson John Kirby has noted that while ISIL is proving to be a determined enemy of the Syrian and Iraqi people, these deaths show that ISIL fighters are not invincible. Their leaders' deaths also demonstrate, he said, that this is a career path with a short shelf life. If that is what you want to choose to do with your life, you're going to be held to account. Spokesperson Kirby has also noted that there are times when ISIL has and will achieve a tactical advance. But if an observer looks at what the coalition and indigenous forces on the ground have achieved over the past year, what can be seen is a steady diminution of ISIL's power and influence. They are shrinking their territorial gains, and they are losing leaders. They are losing foot soldiers. They are losing equipment that they can't readily replace. Recently, the Pentagon announced another important development in the fight against ISIL. Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook noted that the United States and Turkey have finalized technical details for Turkey's full integration into the coalition's air tasking order. This means, he said, Turkey is now going to be flying alongside with other coalition aircraft, a significant step forward. He noted that Turkey is already allowing the use of Turkish bases for U.S. strikes and supporting aircraft. That's been a very important force multiplier, said Press Secretary Cook, as we expect it will continue to complement our efforts to pressure ISIL on a number of fronts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.